And because of the persecution, as I say, in the 4th century,
they already established the calendar for Israel. And as I say, even though in Babylonia, you had the major part of the Talmud in those days, although Jews had already spread throughout the Roman Empire, Europe and Africa, you name it, wherever they go, the Jews settled. But nevertheless, they all followed the practice of Babylonia in this respect, and therefore, one of the things is, you know, as far as the second day Yom Tov, as I said earlier this evening, you know, that this became an accepted minhag and new people to this very day, because it has become sanctified. Okay? Another difference we learned in the Gemara in Tainus many years ago, when the question is, you know, when do you start in to say She'elas Hashem? In other words, when do we begin praying that the rain should come as part of the regular Shmona Esra? Mashiva Ruach is not in the same category. Mashiva Ruach is considered the Gurus Hashemim. In other words, we praise God for being Ato Gibor the Yom Hashem, right? You are mighty and so on. And of course, we praise Him because, you know, Chayim Abesim, God restores life, and this life is given to all of us, right? But at the same time, part of these Gevuras is also Masha Baruch, who causes the wind to blow, or Mori HaGashem, and causes the rain to come. But that is considered praise of God. When do we actually begin to pray for rain? So here there's a difference between Eretz Israel, tomorrow it says something, but it's okay, between Eretz Israel and between the Golah, the diaspora. In Eretz Israel, they begin saying it on the seventh day of Cheshvan. How do they come to that conclusion that this is the time when the rain should begin falling? The answer is because they thought in terms of people who made the pilgrimage, if you remember, to the Shalayim for Sukkot, and how long it would take after the conclusion of the Sukkot holidays for the pilgrims to get back to the Golah. Well, they didn't have airplanes in those days, they had to go on foot by now, okay? And it's a long walk. Pardon me? By Golah, the Golah, I didn't say Golah, no, I said Golah. The Golah, they usually identify with Babel, although we have others. But on that basis, this is why they didn't want the rain to begin falling earlier than the seventh day of Tishrei, in order not to put impediments in the way of the pilgrims who returned to their homes, okay? So that's when they began. And to this day, in Eretz Israel, you begin on the seventh day of Cheshvan, to recite the same Talmud of the Prophet, okay? But in the Golah, they followed the custom of Babylonia. Geography was different over there. They wanted the rains not at that time of the year, because they were still busy with sowing and the harvesting and everything else, you see. So they decided that they were going to begin saying the same Talmud of the 60th day of Tekufas Tishrei. So we still follow that, and this is why in the Siddur, you know, they equivocate. Sometimes they'll tell you the 60th day of Tekufas Tishrei, right? And other times they'll tell you the 4th of December, the 5th of December, the 6th of December, we begin saying it, okay? It all depends. From one year to the next, it varies a little bit by a day or so, okay? So, this is a story, but we follow whom? We follow the Minhag of Babel in this particular case. So, as we can see, the problem of Minhag is a very, very difficult problem, because Jews have practices wherever they live, then they had their own Minhagim. But you are expected to observe the Minhag that your fathers kept, right? You're expected to observe the minhag of the area in which you live and things like that. So, if you're davening in a shul which is Ashkenazic, you follow the Ashkenazic custom. You follow in a shul where they daven with a Sfarim, with a Hari, or whatever it may be, you follow their particular custom, okay? And if you follow the Musaf Ashkenaz, so normally what do? Normally we bind our tefillin and wrap it
in towards us, right? So if you follow the Tzitzvah, what do? They bind it out instead of in and so on. All right, so whatever your father did, this is what you're expected to do in this case. Okay? So Minhag is very, very important. Oh, absolutely. Beit Yisrael loves all the Minhagim, as long as we observe it.
Yeah, right.
Okay. Yeah, now they continue with the Gemara. Okay. Yeah, we come now to a new problem. All right? Problem is the Liarakos. Mishnah itself says that what? That the first of Tishrei is the new year as far as the tithing of vegetables is concerned. Yerakos. You know, remember on Pesach, what do we say? Right. On earth and show Yerakos, right? We eat all kinds of vegetables, right? Okay. But Halayla Hazeh, more tonight we must eat bitter herbs. Okay. So Yerakos are vegetables. So Rosh Hashanah is the time that we decide the cutoff point, if you wish, as far or the beginning, whatever you want to consider it, for establishing the tithing of vegetables. Okay. So the Gemara asked the following question. It says, Tana, we have a teaching, happens to be a Tosefta in this particular case, but in other words, you know, it's not in the Mishnah, but it's taken from outside the Mishnah. Okay? Now what does it say over there? It says, Liarakos Ulamaslos Lidorim. Says that Rosh Hashanah, in other words, the first day of Tishrei is the Rosh Hashanah as far as vegetables and tithes, right, and Nidorim, Nidorim of vows. We'll understand that in a moment when we take a look at it, you know, as we analyze it. The Gemara, first of all, asks the following questions. The Yerakos, my Ninhu, what are they talking about when they say Yerakos, vegetables? You say, Maser Yerek, right? This is the tithing of the vegetables. That's what we mean. It doesn't mean that it's the birthday of the vegetables, but it means that as far as tithing, we need a date. And that date is the first of Tishrei. So they say, Maser Yerek, he says, it's the Haidu Masvos. Isn't that included when it says that Rosh Hashanah, that the first of Tishrei is the Rosh Hashanah for tithes in general? So why do they have to single that out? So he says, Tana de Rabbanon, the Katoni de Oraisa. He says, we're talking about two different types of miser, two different types of tithing. There is a tithe, which he says is the Rabbanon. In other words, it is not biblically ordained that you should tithe this, but the rabbis decided that we should tithe these also, okay? Naturally, what are we talking about? Right, we're talking about vegetables. Because what does the Torah say as far as tithing is concerned? Torah says, Basar de Godcha, in other words, tithing of your grain, Tiroshcha, which means your oil, and then the Yitzharecha, and your wine, okay? So, in other words, these three things are to be tithed according to the Bible, the Deraisa, right? Namely, grains, whatever they may be, particularly wheat, but you know, this is it, right? And grapes or wine, right? And oil or the olives. Okay, all right. These are what are biblically ordained. So, what he's saying over here is that what this particular teaching that we have quoted says is first, you know, that he quotes those things that are the Rabbanon, namely what the rabbi said, vegetables in general, the Katoni de Oraisa, and we also learned that in this case in the Mishnah, you know, what is ordained by the Torah. So now they ask the following question, says, Velisne de Oraisa Bereisha. So, why shouldn't we give the honor first to mention what it has to be tithed according to the law of the Torah? Let that first be mentioned, right? And then after that, we'll have, you know, what the rabbis added, right? So why do they first talk about Eurocos and then they add Lysimos in general, which would refer, in other words, to what the Bible has ordained. So he says, the reason is as follows. He says, at least in the right side of Bereshit, you're supposed to teach for the Torah first, right? So he says, the reason is that he loved so much, that is the person who, you know, gave this teaching, he loved so much the idea that the rabbis want to show the Rabbeinu Shalalem that they're willing to go beyond the strict letter and have Meiser also, even if the Torah itself did not command it. And they show their love by doing it. So therefore, this is why he mentions it first. Okay. So, now it comes for Tana Didan. And why the Mishnah only mentions what? The Rokos. It doesn't mention anything else. So why doesn't it say, Rokos, Baishwas, or Sefinon? So the answer is that Tana Darabonin, they teach us, you know, what the rabbis said that has to be tithed, in other words, Eurocos, vegetables, the Kosh King Doraisa. And all the more so, it's understood that if this has to be tithed, then certainly those things that the Torah itself commanded that we tithe have to be tithed. So now they say, well, least in Meiser, maybe instead of saying, you know, Maisros, which means tithes, plural, right? Why doesn't it simply say the word Maser? That's all. Rosh Hashanah for Maser, period. And that would include everything, right? So the answer is, because we have different types of Maser. Echod Maser Behemo, the Echod Maser Dagon. We have not only the tithe that we mentioned before, you know, for the grain, but we also have learned previously to what? That you also have a tithe of cattle. And this, remember, we discussed, you know, that when an animal is born within a certain year, so you get them together, put them in the pen, and then let them out one after another, and number 10 is always marked with a red dye, so that we know that that has to be eaten as miser, okay? So we have different, and this is the reason why it says mice roast, because we do have more than one type of miser. The list there, Yerek. So now they say, all right, good, let's go back to the language. Why does it say Yerokos, which means, of course, again, vegetables, right? Why doesn't it say simply Yerek, the vegetable tithe? And it's understood, vegetable means everything that's a vegetable, right? So he says, the reason is because Trey Gavna Yerek, there are actually two different types of vegetables. Ditnan, as we learned in the Mishnah, it happens to be a Mishnah in Maisros, you know, where they deal with tithing in general, it's devoted to that idea. He says over there, we learn, Yerek HaNe'egad Mishayogeit, Mishaynu Ne'egad Mishayimali Ezhakli. We make a differentiation between vegetables that have to be bundled together at the time when, let's say, we sell them in the market. Carrots, beets, I mean, these kind of things, you know, that we know, that they always come tied up as a, you know, as a bundle, okay? So, when the time comes that they're ripe enough and ready for the market enough and they have to be bundled, that's the time when tithing has to take place from them. But the she'enu ne'ekad, but when you have vegetables that are not tied together, for example, a cabbage, cauliflower, or something like that, I mean, where you sell individual items, and you know, you don't. So then, when do they become subject to tithing? It's the she'yimalei hakli. When you take a basket and you fill it, then they become liable to tithing. So that's the reason why it doesn't say Yerek in the singular, but it says what? It says Yerokos. Okay. Now, so far, we're talking about the language. Now they introduce another idea, taken from Tosefta. Ton Rabbanan, our sages taught, Liket Yerek, Erev Rosh Hashanah, Achelei Tovei HaShemesh, The cause of it decayed. I have to give you the next page. Okay, pass. Okay, one pass these out, please. Mishetavei Hashemesh Ein Tominu Ma'asu Mizeh Al Zeh. Okay, let me explain that right now so everybody have a copy of it. Okay, getting back to the previous side. Okay, alright, this is what it says. Men gathered. Okay, if a person gathered, not sure what he gathered, let's say we're talking about Yerek, alright, we're talking about vegetables. Okay, men went out and they gathered vegetables Erev Rosh Hashanah, okay, day before Rosh Hashanah, Ad Shelei Tovei HaShemesh, which means while the sun had not yet set, right, and then the Chos of Ali came Mishu Tovei HaShemesh, and then he went and he again gathered after the sun had set. I don't know what he's doing gathering after the sun had set. He had no business doing it at that time. But let's take it, stretch it a little bit and say, in other words, until Rosh Hashanah, you know, until the evening of Rosh Hashanah, he gathered vegetables. And then, after Rosh Hashanah had started, right, and then, you know, when he was permitted, let's say, to gather vegetables again, so he gathered vegetables, okay? That's what I'm saying. It doesn't, it's pastished, you know. Certainly not allowed to do any agricultural labor on that day. Okay, that's understood. Okay? And even this business, unless actually he was going to eat, the possibility might be, not that we're talking about that he gathered, let's say, those vegetables that, you know, that have to be bundled, but let's say he gathered a pot full of vegetables, okay, and he wants to use it on Rosh Hashanah, he wants to cook himself a meal, okay? So, what he did, and, you know, he got them together, let's say, on Rosh Hashanah, say, I'm not happy with that, because I would rather prefer my first explanation, namely that any time after Rosh Hashanah, he went out and he gathered vegetables together, okay? But at any rate, it's now what? Is it the same year or not? Even though one until sunset it was this year, and after sunset, right, it's another one. So the answer is, right, Ein Tormin, you're not allowed to take Truma, Uma Asrin, nor are you allowed to do tithing, Mizeh Al Zeh, from the one that you gathered previously to the one that you now gathered, you know, after the start of Rosh Hashanah. In other words, he cannot take from the old and use it for tithing for the new. You understand? Lefi she'ein tormin u'masrin, right? Because we do not take truma. Truma, if you remember, this is given to whom? To the kohen, right? Okay. Nor do we take it. Originally, yeah, truma is always for the kohen. U'masrin, nor do we take the various tithes. Lo min ha-chodosh al ha-yoshon, right? Not from the new batch for the old year. Lo min ha-yoshon al ha-chodosh, nor from the old batch for the new year. In other words, the two separate years, and we see that Rosh Hashanah marks the turning point, right?
So that you hadn't done everything you were supposed to do in the old year,
yeah,
you can't borrow from the new year.
That is correct. That is correct. But you could still do it from the old one, right? You have old produce still around that you could do it. That would belong for the previous year, and so on. But let's remember right now another very pertinent idea. We say mas ros, tithes. There are various tithes. In general, you know, when it comes to the doggone tirosh for Yitzchar, right? In other words, the grain, the wine, the oil, okay? These things have three different categories of tithes. We have what we call Maaseh Rishon, first tithe. Who does this 10% go to? The answer is, huh?
It goes, actually, it goes originally to the Levi. It's meant to go to the Levi, okay? Then you have, by the way, and the Levi in turn had to give 10% of what they received, and that's what we call Truma's Maaser, so they had to give that to the Kohen, okay? This is according to the law of the Bible, okay, law of the Torah. So then you have Maaser Sheni, second tithe, which, according to the Torah, that has to be taken to the Beis HaMikdash, has to be taken actually to Yerushalayim, doesn't it? Okay? It has to be taken to Yerushalayim, and that has to be enjoyed in Yerushalayim. And, of course, if, remember, we mentioned time and again, you know, that if the fruits, let's say, the vegetables would spoil by the time that you reach Yerushalayim, then in that particular case, you sell it, and you take the money and tie it up, and then you bring it and you spend it in the Yerushalayim for all kinds of food and wine and drink, etc. Okay. And then we have Maaser Shlishi. We have the third tithe, also called Maaser Oni, because this is a tithe which is given to the poor people. Okay. Now, do we give all three maaseros at the same year? The answer is no. You never give more than two maaseros in 1 year. We go in a 7 year cycle, okay? So, the first year we give maaser rishon and maaser sheni, okay? In other words, you give to the Levi and also you take to Yerushalayim, okay? Second year of the cycle, again, the same thing. Maaser rishon and maaser sheni, okay? The third year of the cycle, you have maaser rishon. That still is there. We have to give to the Levi, right? But instead of taking to Yerushalayim the next 10% that you would take off, that 10% instead is given to the poor people. That's Maaser Oni. And then the fourth year again does what we do in the first year, fifth year what we would do in the second year, and the sixth year what we would do in the third year. And then, of course, the seventh year being the year of Shemitah, when nothing belongs to you, literally what grows in the field, so in that case you don't give Trumas and Maaseros at that time. Yeah. Yes, Beverly. Yeah.
What are the poor people or lady supposed to do to give if
you're not Well, we have other forms of relief for them. Don't forget, we have the corner of the field, we have, you know, Peor, Leket, Shicha, okay? And also we have the Dovis. I mean, people are expected, you know, to give charity, right? Expected to help them. Okay. So it's not that, you know, they're neglected, but, you know, it's a different form that we have to help them with. Yes.
So the question about the Maaser Sheni that you're supposed to take to Jerusalem,
right.
I find that interesting. The idea behind that is that you must go on your journey to Jerusalem.
Right.
But you must use that money for your own
enjoyment in Yerushalayim. I mean, this is part of the simcha of being in Yerushalayim and then rejoicing.
I find
right.
that very interesting, yeah, that right. is the importance of celebrating a simcha
right.
is really based on the idea that it's really you must do it.
Oh, yeah. Torah says several times that, you know, Pasha Reh says, so machtol if they are the Shem Lekecha, you shall rejoice in the presence of the Lord your God.
And it makes it very clear in Mishnah how you're supposed to do it.
Right, absolutely. Yes. Yes.
Well,
David? Yes.
Following Beverly's question, what then happens to the poor
No, no. What happens in the seventh year is that everything is hefker. Everything belongs to whoever wants to come and pick it. That's the answer. So they're not starving at that.
If everyone is allowed to pick, you're allowed to pick it yourself.
You can pick for yourself for your own use, correct. But you cannot pick in order to sell. That you can't do. That's correct.
And you can't take a double portion, like
no, that would be cheating.
That would be cheating.
That's cheating, exactly. Yeah.
It's like, well, it would turn bad, like the
like the bun, absolutely.
Right.
You take, right, you're allowed to take what you need for your own use. You're allowed to take what you need for the use of your cattle and so on, you understand?
Yeah.
and for the use even of the wild beasts of the field, you know, you're allowed, you know, because they have to be taken care of too, believe it or not, okay? You cannot use it in order to do any business. You cannot make any profit out of it and so on, and it's free for everybody.
Amazing society.
It is.
When I think of it,
yeah,
it's just
right.
Of
course, it's, you know, it's an idealized.
They were so tied to the land.
Right.
It doesn't work when you think about it.
Yeah, today, I mean, it's much more difficult to observe. I agree with you.
They may have been
right.
Among them that might have been.
Yeah.
But they lived by the rules.
Yes.
So
right, they did. They did, no question that they did. But, you know, we're talking about something that happened thousands of years ago. Today, we still try to apply, but it's much more difficult to apply. I mean, Beverly pointed out, we're living in a different type of an age. And even in Eretz Yisrael, where people observe Trumas, Masvos, and everything else, but still, I don't know whether today, you know, people feel free, let's say, to go into any field and help themselves. They see a banana plantation, to go and to grab a banana. Or if they see an orange orchard, you know, to go and help themselves to an orange. I'm not too sure that it works that way.
And also, on the reverse, I don't think that our people, I don't think people today have that kind of discipline to observe, even if they mean to and they want to. I just don't think, I think there was something extraordinary about the time.
There's no question about it. No question. I agree with you. All right, let me just do a couple of more lines and we'll call it a night. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. All right. So, we've already determined what? That Rosh Hashanah is a cutoff point, right? And that we cannot use what was prior to Rosh Hashanah as for Tumas and Masvos for the new year. And vice versa. What grows in the new year, we cannot apply for the old year. Instead, you take from each year separately. Okay. So far, so good. Then it continues and it says, Im hoyesosh niyo nechneses nishlishis. Let's say, what is the second year, what grew in the second year, but it first came, you know, when were you first able to harvest it? In the third year, right? So in that case, what? What grows in the second year, Shniya, is Maaseh Rishon, Maaseh Sheni, right? Then that, in that second year, you're still obligated to give what? First tithe and second tithe, right? Shlishis, but if you gather it in the third year, then what do you have to do with it? So Maaseh Rishon, Maaseh Oni. Then in that particular case, you give the first tithe and you give the third tithe, right? The one that goes to the poor people. So how do we know that each has their own proper year with the proper cycles? The answer is, how do we know it? So Rav Yehoshua ben Levi, he said, because the pasuk says, Ki sechale la seris kol masat v'eschov ha'shona ha'shlishis, when you finish the tithing of all the tithing of your grain in the third year, which is Shnas HaMaaser, and it's the year of tithing. So what does it mean? What does that pasuk mean? It says, Shono She'ein Bo, says that shows us that the third year is what? It's a year, She'ein Bo Ela Maaser Echad. It's a year in which you have only one tithe. In other words, not three, but only, you know, one and one is what it means. But not one, one, and one, right? Okay, so how does it work out? So he says what I said a moment ago. Maaseh Rishon and Maaseh Oni, right? Then the third year would be the first tithe and also the tithe given to the poor, in other words, what we call Maaseh Shlishi, right? Maaseh Sheni Yibotel. And second tithe that year is cancelled out. You don't give it. Oh, I know. Or maybe we should say as follows, Elo Af Maaseh Rishon, right? Name Yibotel. Maybe we should say that when it says one tithe, maybe it means that you give only the Maaseh Oni and you don't give the first one to the Levim. So Talmud Lomos says that can't be. Why? Because it's written, the El Halvim to Daber, you are to speak to the Levim, the Omar to Lehem, and say to them, Ki Sikhu Me Yesh Ben Yisrael Hamaaser, when you receive from the children of Israel the tithe, asher nasati lachem yitom, which I have given unto you from them, benachal aschem, as your possession. So, ikishoh hakosuv lenachalo. In other words, the tithe given to the Levi, in other words, the Masir Rishon, is compared to an inheritance. Ma nachalo ein lo hefsek, just as an inheritance or possession, there is no break, you continue to own it all the time, so af Masir Rishon ein lo hefsek. So, likewise, when it comes to Masir Rishon, there is no cessation. In other words, you have to give Masir Rishon year 1, year 2, year 3, year 4, year 5, year 6, because this is a nachalo, right? This belongs to the Levim. Just as I said, only in the year of Shemitah that we don't, okay? Because what you're growing in the field, or what grows by itself in the field, you know, you're not allowed to do it. And so, and as we said, it's hefka for everybody. Everybody can come and enjoy it.
And
okay.
A lot of them consider it a lowly thing to do. For example, the Kohen himself would have to go out also.
Well, the Kohen would go sometimes looking for trumas. There's no question about that. There was a change made in the law subsequently, because the Levium, many of them refused to come back to Eretz Yisrael at the time of Ezra. So their punishment was that the Baisa that should have gone to them was given instead to the Kahana. Okay. But as I say, today it's all symbolic. We don't have a Beis HaMikdash, so that we don't give Baisa either to a Levi or to a Kohen. Instead, what we do, we separate it, and then either we bury it or whatever it may be. Okay. There are certain things that we have to do. And in Eretz Yisrael to this day, they're very careful about taking out Trumas HaMashmash. Of course, I'm talking about people who observe it.
Yeah.
They do that. Okay? Yeah.
So they observe Shemitah?
Oh, yeah. As far as Shemitah is concerned, the religious kibbutzim, for the most part today, observe Shemitah.
So
not all of them, because what happened was, back around the beginning of the 20th century, when you began to have, you know, agricultural settlements in Eretz Yisrael, there was also very great poverty. And so Harav Kork came with his bezdin, and he made, you know, like a illegal fiction. Namely, they sell the land of Eretz Yisrael to a goy, an Arab, right, Mustafa, whoever it is, you know, Abdullah, he owns Eretz Yisrael that year. So that in reality, the land doesn't belong to a Jew, it belongs to a goy. Land that belongs to a goy is not subject to Shemitah, you understand? So this is a legal fiction that some people rely on. But yeah, right, right. You have no question. And selling chametz is similar, right? But there are many kibbutzim and moshavim today that refuse to abide by that, and they taka, they don't do any agricultural work at all during the seventh year. They observe Shemitah. For them, there are special funds that are raised always prior to that year in order to help them tide over economically. But as I said, some time ago, also there are different things that can be done in order to alleviate the situation somewhat. In other words, let's say that you develop a system of raising fruits and vegetables hydroponically. Okay, that's one way to do it, because it's not actually in the ground, right? But it's removed from the ground and some chemicals and things like that. So that's one way that you know that they get around it. And then, of course, many of the kibbutzim today, let's say, have fish ponds. All right, the law applies, as we said, you know, to fruits, vegetables, right? Wine, oil, olives, grapes, all right, this is what it applies to, but it doesn't apply to fish. Fish are not subject to mice. So you can, if you develop a good business of fish ponds, then that's also a source of revenue, okay? There are kibbutzim and moshavim and Eretz Yisrael where, for example, they open up factories for the manufacture of different things. That, again, is not subject to the law of Shemitah, because you're not dealing with the soil.
unless it's whatever the manufacturer is coming from the soil.
Yeah, all right. But I'm not talking about that. I'm talking, for example, like a place.
What is the diamond? Diamonds come from the ground.
But it's not a fruit or a vegetable.
You don't eat it.
So it's not subject to it. Okay. Flowers is a problem because it grows from the ground. Okay, that already is. Okay. Correct. That's already, it's a shiloh, not that. Okay, I have to admit. It's a shiloh. Okay. But, for example, you take Kibbutz Lavi, one of the most beautiful of the kibbutzim in Eretz Yisrael. And, you know, they have a factory where they manufacture shul furniture, standards, benches, and things like that, and so on. And that can operate there. So that's a source of income.
Has hydroponics. They have all the agriculture.
Yeah.
They have large hydroponics and a plastic factory.
Yeah. Okay. Tonight is the 24th
of November.
Thanksgiving. Right, the Sarah of Thanksgiving. Right, 1999 is still the year. We're still learning Gemara Rosh Hashanah. We're on Yud Beis Amud Beis.
Right.
Good. Okay, Yud Beis Amud Beis. I'll tell you exactly where we are right now. Just a little past the middle. Last week we finished the whole discussion about the various Maaseros and how it relates to the seventh year also. So tonight we start with another statement made in the Mishnah that, namely, the first of Nisan is Linedorim. In other words, it's the Rosh Hashanah, marks the beginning of the year as far as vows are concerned. Okay. So at this point, I have to make a distinction between the kind of vows that we've been dealing with in the past as compared to the kind of vows that they're talking about right now. All along, when we were talking about the sanctity of the word and, you know, that you have to fulfill the pledge and so on, there, the Nedarim that they were talking about dealt with animals that you had to bring as sacrifices to the Beis HaMikdash. You made a vow that you were going to bring it, and, you know, and then the question was, how much time did you have in order to fulfill the obligation of bringing, you know, the what you were vowed, okay? And right, so that's what we had, you know, Shalosh Regalim, or even other ideas that said that the very first regal, or the second regal, but the accepted one that we learned was finally that it was Shalosh Regalim, and not only that, but they have to be Kesidron. In other words, we must always start counting the three with Pesach, Shavuot, Sukkot. So that we learned, you know, that if you vowed, let's say, before Shavuot or Sukkot, you might have either four or five different festivals in order to be able to fulfill your vow. Here, what we're talking about is a different type. There's a whole Gemara in the Nedarim which deals nothing at all with the pledges of animals that you promised to give to the Beis HaMikdash. Instead, it deals with the basic problem that people make vows concerning other people, or even concerning themselves. Concerning themselves, for example, they may say to themselves, I take a vow that I'm not going to eat this and this. Let's say a vegetarian. Okay? You make a vow saying, I refuse to, I make a vow that I'm not going to touch meat. Okay? And he may either say forever, or he may be for a certain amount of time. As we'll see over here, the question is, if he says for a year, okay? Could be just for 30 days too, you know. You can have different times that you set for yourself. That's where you make a vow for yourself. But you could also make a vow concerning other people. Either you say, for example, I refuse to have anything to do with the guy next door, or I could say, whatever I have, that is, I won't take anything from him, right? Or I can say, I refuse to give anything that I have to the guy next door. Okay? You can make such a vow. It's a crazy reason, but, you know, whatever it may be, people do get angry with each other, right? And so sometimes they would take a vow that they wouldn't the, do something to the other person.
You have
yes.
to say that this is a vow, but or suppose you say it just as a matter of speech.
If you say either Neder Olai, Cherem Olai, Konam Olai, there are different, the Gemara in the Dorim has all kinds of different substitute expressions. And the question is whether these substitute expressions are just as binding as if he had said the original words, such as Neder or Cherem and so on, which imply that, you know, I have nothing to do, okay, I can. It's prohibited, absolutely prohibited to me. So this is what they're saying now concerning Rosh Hashanah. These kind of Nidar. Tana Rabbanan. Okay, we're just a little past the bottom. Past the middle of page. Yud Beis, Amid Beis. Okay, you see where it says Tana Rabbanan?
Yeah.
Okay, Tana Rabbanan, it says Hamudar Hano Mechaviro. Okay, Lishana. Person takes a vow and he says, I vow that I'm not going to have any enjoyment of any profit, whatever it may be, from another person for a year, right? Mm-hmm. So in that case, Monesh named Osir Chodesh Miyom Liyom. He has to count 12 months from day to day. In other words, it must be a complete year, and only at the conclusion of the year is the vow lifted. Okay? Okay. However, the Yimomar, let's say that he made the vow in this language. He said, Lishona Zu, I refuse, you know, to have anything to do, to have any benefit whatever from the other person for this year, right? So even if the day that he made the vow was the 29th day of Elul, and of course what's the next day? Rosh Hashanah. Okay, Kevin Shigia Yemecha B'Tishrei, the moment that the first day of Tishrei has arrived, also the Yeshana, and the year is complete. So, okay. So, the Gemara continues to say, Safidu Lamandoma Yomecha Bishonin Choshu Shona, even in accordance with the person who says that one day in the year is not considered a year. We had such opinions before, because there was an opinion, for example, that less than 30 days is not considered a year. 30 days can be considered a year, but anything less than that cannot be considered. Okay? So, that's a different opinion. Okay. So, even in accordance with that opinion, the person who holds that opinion, nevertheless, what? Let's see, Yurei Nafshe Kabil Olay. He only took upon himself a vow to literally to afflict himself, to afflict his soul, literally, okay? The law, it's too late, and he did it. So since he did it, so in this particular case, even that authority would be willing to accept that one day is enough if he said, Lishono Zu, for this year. Right, so you have to be careful, in other words, as to how you phrase whatever pledges and whatever language, you know, you use in this connection, okay? Excuse me for a minute, I feel... Okay, I just want to add one thing in reference to these Nidorim, because it shoots right back again to the whole problem of tithing. That is, we realize that if a person makes a Neder, he has to fulfill it. He's serious about it, and so on. But nevertheless, what happens if a person realizes that he made a big mistake in making a Neder? Is there any way... to get out of it. Is it possible? The answer is yes, but you have to go to a chacham, in other words, somebody who is an authority, or to a bezdin, right? And then they're going to ask you questions. At the time that you made the neder, did you realize what you were saying? Did you realize what the consequences of the neder would be? And if the person says, no, at the time, you know, I did not really realize what the consequences would be, then in that case, they have the authority to cancel out the neder. Okay. And this is what we call Hatoras Nedorim. Right. Now, of course, what we do, Erev Rosh Hashanah, is a mass Hatoras Nedorim, so to speak. Right. But for an individual basis, then there's no question that you can go to, as I say, either a recognized Chacham, you know, somebody who's considered an authority in Jewish law, or to a Bezdin, And the Besdin could be maybe with one person who knows what it's all about, and people, you know, who are familiar with what's going on the street, even if they're not ordained rabbis or anything like that, and have the vow canceled. Okay, hi, good evening, good evening. We are... Oh, yes, yes, of course. All right, we go back now to what we were learning about the whole business about... Okay, there's one thing I forgot to mention in connection with the previous one. Okay. So now the Gemara asks the following. This is still in connection with the Neder. It says, Ve'emo Nisan. Let's say that the first of Nisan should be the day upon which a year ends as far as the Dorim are concerned, or the beginning of a new year, right? For the Dorim. So he says, "B'nidorim haloich achar loshim b'nayod." No, when it comes to Nidorim, you have to go, you have to follow that which people normally talk, what they normally say. What does the average person say? When is Rosh Hashanah? First of Tishrei. They don't think in terms of Rosh Hashanah being the first of Nisan. You understand? So that therefore, when they take a Neder, obviously what they have in mind when they say either the Shana or the Shana Zu, but particularly Shana Zu we're talking about, that they have in mind the first day of Tishrei. They do not have in mind the first day of Nisan. All right. So now we go back again to the problem of how long does a plant have to be in the ground or show some sign of maturity so that we'll know in connection with Maisros as to whether it said. Now what we're discussing is when do we consider either that, you know, it belongs to a previous year or does it belong to a new year? Okay, this is the problem. Okay, so it says over here, and they quote right now a Mishnah.
What do you mean by a previous year?
Was planted prior to Rosh Hashanah.
Oh, you mean the plants you're talking about?
Plant was prior, okay. Okay, the plant was planted prior to Rosh Hashanah. The question is, does it go by the day of planting, or does it go by some other method of ascertaining as to when Miser becomes, that is, what Miser should be come affected. Okay. In other words, let's say that this was the first year of the cycle. Okay? He planted it towards the end of the first year of the cycle. Okay? Talking about the cycle, I mean, you know, the 7-year cycle. Right. Okay? All right. The plant, however, did not begin to appear before after Rosh Hashanah. Right, of the following year. So the question is, which Miser are we obligated to take from this? Would it be, well, Miser Rishon goes without saying, I mean, that has to be neither case, right? But should it be, for example, Miser, well, even Miser Sheni would be the same thing as far as the first and second year is concerned. But let's say it's in the second year. That's an easier thing to understand. It's the second year, and Rosh Hashanah is the beginning of the third year of the cycle. Okay, we've already learned that what Maisers are given in years 1 and 2, the answer is you take Maiser Rishon, the one that goes to the Levi, technically, according to the Torah, right? And the one that you have to bring to Yerushalayim, the Maiser Sheni, correct? Whereas in the third year, we learned what? That in the third year, Maiser Rishon is still obligatory, but instead of Maiser Sheni, there is no Maiser Sheni that year, but instead it is Maiser Ani, or Maiser Shlishi, whichever you want to call it. That's the what you have to give to the poor person, the tithe, okay? So the question is, this plant, which has now produced something after Rosh Hashanah, are the Maisers of this particular plant supposed to be for the prior year, the year it was planted? Or is it for the current year, the year in which we first see some activity in the ground? You understand? This is what the question is. So they quote a Mishnah right now. Mishnah says, non-Hosom, we learned over there in the Mishnah, happens to be in Tractic Maestros, says, Hatilton Mishatitzbach. Tilton is what they call, according to Rashi and according to others, fenugreek. Some sort of a plant used for spices and I don't know what else they use it for, okay? Maybe for medicine. But anyway, it's called fenugreek.
Fenugreek.
Greek, Greek. In French, it's Greek. In English, it's Greek. Okay. Rashi calls it fenugreek.
Is that what we're spelling? Huh? We're speaking English now?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. The name is actually, it's based upon, an old botany term, okay?
Fennel.
Fennel is like fennel, I imagine, okay? Which is, used for spices, okay? All right, and it's a certain type that they say, this is Greek fennel, okay? Fenugreek, okay? So, or Greek. this, it says, when is Miser, when does the obligation of Miser fall upon this particular plant? It is Meshet Titzmach, right? Titzmach means when it begins to blossom forth. In other words, when you see it first coming out of the ground, this is when the obligation falls upon it. Not from the time when it was planted, but from the time when it first comes out from the ground. Okay? Hatvua v'hazesim. Now, as far as grain and olives are concerned, mishiyaviyu shlish. They are obligated, that is, they fall under the obligation of Miser, the year when they have brought forth one third of their normal growth. Okay? In other words, by the time that you have one third, you already recognize two things. First of all, that they definitely have a plant, and that it's viable, and that it's going to grow, and eventually you'll be able to harvest it, right? But also, even if you cut it down, let's say, in the third, when it's only one third growth, it may not taste that good, but still, technically, it already has become edible to a certain extent. Okay? So that, therefore, in the case of grain, tvua, but as we'll see, Rashi actually includes under tvua two different categories. Because remember, we said, Miser from the Torah applies to the gancha, Tiroshcha, the Yitzarecha. The Gantcha is the grain that grows in the field, right? Tiroshcha, this is the grapes from which we make wine. And the Yitzarecha, these are the olives from which olive oil can be made. So that for these categories, it is not, Mishatitzmach, when it first begins to sprout forth, but rather when they have attained one third of their growth. Okay. And the Gemara now says, what do you mean Mishatitzmach? What do you mean by Mishatitzmach when it sprouts forth? Going back again to where before we said about Tiltum, right? So he says, Mishatitzmach is brilliant. He says it has to sprout forth to the extent that it can produce seeds. If it's immature enough and it does not yet produce seeds that, could be planted, and in turn they'll grow into other plants, then in that particular case it's not mature enough. But when it reaches that particular point where you can see seeds emerging, then in that particular case, this is the time that they fall under the obligation of giving maizpahs. So as I said before, if you planted it in the second year, but this thing first came, this phenomenon first occurred in the third year, then in that case the maizpahs that you would give would be for the third year of the cycle. Yeah. So now the question is, how do they derive all this business, right? That again, it's a repeat of the fact that, with the case of wine, that is grapes, right, and olives, and any kind of a grain that grows in the field, this is when it has produced one third of its growth. Okay. So now the Gemara asks the following question. Minohane mile, how do we know? Where in the Torah, for example, do we find a reference to this? And we find a source for this. The Torah speaks about what? It speaks about that you have to give meiser. That's what the Torah says. But does the Torah define at what particular point in the plant's growth you have to give the meiser? When does it actually, attain its obligation? So this, they're looking for a pasuk. Well, the point is you would set it aside then.
You'd set it aside, right.
But you know that this, is now for the new year, and therefore the meiser would be that you give, from this plant and any plant that grows subsequently at the same, the same year, would be 10% of whatever grows, and it would be according to the cycle of what that particular year is. Let's say it happened during the third year that you planted it, and then it first began to sprout in the fourth year, right? Then in that case, you go back again to what you normally would give in the fourth year, namely Maaser Rishon and Maaser Sheni. Okay? This is the idea. With trees, if you remember, we had a different question. This goes back a couple of weeks ago where we spoke about trees, and there we said, that in the case of trees, if you planted it prior to Rosh Hashanah, how many days? 30 days. Remember, that was the 38 day, the 30 day business, right? Then in that particular case, it would not be subject to Shviyas in the following year, because we would say that that tree already had begun its life in the previous year. Okay. Now, they want to know Minohane Mile. How can we derive this from the Torah? So Omer Rabbi Yochanan. So Rabbi Asi said the name of Rabbi Yochanan. He says, but there are some who say instead it was Mishmeh Rabbi Yossi Aglili. It wasn't the name of Rabbi Yochanan, but it was the name of Rabbi Yossi Aglili. All right, at any rate, whichever of these great Tanoim, Omar Quod, they interpret the pasuk as follows. The Torah says, Miket Sheva Shonim, Bimoech Nasashmita, Bechakasukosh Nasashmita. Okay. We would really have to see what the pasuk says over there. The pasuk has absolutely nothing to do with what? With Meiser. I have to be honest. If we go according to Pshat, it has nothing to do with it. What are we talking about over there? We're talking about the mitzvah of Hakel. Alright, remember what Hakel is? Hakel is that once every 7 years, at the conclusion of the Shnas HaShmita, the following Sukkos, right? So then they would erect, we learned this in Gemara and Sota, that they would erect a bima, a platform in the Beis HaMikdash, and people, naturally were there for the Sukkos festival, and Bevo Kol Yisrael, says the Torah, when all Israel comes, Levi Roy says, Panei Hashem Alekecha, in order to appear before the Yod HaGod, Tikros HaTorah HaZos, right? You are to read this Torah, the Yod Znehem. Read it to them, so that their ears get it, okay? And then the next pasuk is, Hakel HaSawam, HaNoshim, HaNoshim, HaTaf, all the people, men, women, children, and so on, bring them over there, in order that they should be able to listen to the king at the time when he reads from Sefer Devarim, okay? Alright, so this is the ceremony of Hakel, and the date that the Torah gives is when? It says, Miket Sheva Shanim, at the end of 7 years, right? Bimoed, on the festival, Shnas HaShmita, this would mean at the conclusion, the festival which follows the year of Shmita, the Chag HaSukkos, which is the holiday of Sukkos, right? Shnas HaShmita, and then repeats the words, the year of Shmita. So the question is, why does it say, the kind of wording that the way it is, the festival, the end of 7 days, 7 years, and the festival, the year of Shemitah, and so on, so my avidite. Well, what are you driving at with this pasuk? The Chag HaSukkos. Why do they add, for example, the Chag HaSukkos? They already want the Moed Shnas HaShemitah. So why do they have to say the Chag HaSukkos? So he says, the reason is the wording. he says, Shemines, he says, look, in reality, it is the eighth year. It's no longer the seventh year. The year of Shemitah was what? This was the seventh year, right? But we've already fulfilled seven complete years. When Rosh Hashanah came, what happened? This was the end of the year of Shemitah, right? So that the festival, the Sukkot, which follows, is already in the eighth year, right? Shemini, it's the eighth year. So why do they have to write it the way they did? So, Ela Loma Lecho, but it's in order to teach you that Kol Tvua Shehevia Shlish Bashvi'is Lifnei Rosh Hashanah Atoneheg Boi Minhag Shvi'is Bashminis. It's in order to teach us as follows, that any grain that has already produced one third of its growth in the Shvi'is, in the year of Shemitah, right, in the seventh year, and it did so prior to Rosh Hashanah, Lifnei Rosh Hashanah, you are required to treat this kind of produce, in, even though it's the eighth year and technically Shemitah is over, right? Excuse me. But you have to treat it as a product of Shviyas. Therefore, it means, of course, you can't sell it, right? Can't use it for any commercial purposes and so on, as we said before, you know, yeah, in dealing with what's the difference between right and Shemitah year. So even though it is the eighth year, it didn't automatically take away the fact that since it had already produced one third of its growth during the Shviyas, so therefore this plant is considered as being a plant of Shviyas and not of Shemitah. Omar Rabbi Zeira and Rabbi Asi. So Rabbi Zeira said to Rabbi Asi, absolutely right. Yeah. Here we are. Yud Gimel Okay, pass the Bavakasha. So Rabbi Zeira said to Rabbi Asi, Right. The Dilma Ayel Klal says maybe this particular plant didn't even begin to become ripe even in Shavuos, right? So in that particular case,
you mean it didn't come to fruition,
right,
at all during the seventh
during
year.
The seventh year, right? Okay.
Or at the end of the sixth year,
right? And yet, right. It didn't come to fruition during the seventh year. I'm reading Rashi right now. Let's take a look at the Rashi at the top of the page, okay? Yeah, it says V'dilma lo ayo klal, right? Maybe it didn't even enter, didn't even, you know, begin to flourish or something like that. Okay, ayo normally means to enter. So maybe it didn't happen. Okay, V'dilma lo ayo klal. Rashi says V'afilu lo hischilu hisbashel bashviz. Maybe they did not even begin to ripen in the seventh year, right? Ko'omar Rachmona, the Torah would still say mitzvah shviyis nimoshech utsuriat ha'chasukos, the mitzvah of shviyis, that is, you know, not to do any kind of agricultural work, the prohibition lasts right until Sukkot of the eighth year, milach rosh v'diktzar, right? In other words, let's say that maybe what the pasuk means is as follows. Forget about your interpretation about Avir Shlish. Maybe it didn't even, but maybe even if things did ripen, let's say, in Shviyas, right? Maybe we should say that you should not be able to take advantage of them and to eat them in the eighth year until Sukkot. Maybe that's what it is. In other words, Sukkot is the determining time as to when the year of Shvi ends, the war doesn't end. Maybe that's what it means. Vekaoma Rachmona. And the Torah says, therefore, maybe the meaning would be of the Torah that Tishomet, that the Shemitah idea should continue with Tezel and should go right at Chakasukas until Sukkot. Maybe that's what the Pasuk means. So he says, let's Sakodate. No. Says, don't think along those lines. Dichsiv, because we have another Pasuk. What does the Pasuk say? Pasuk says, V'chag ha'osif, right? The festival of the ingathering, when is it? It's B'tzeis Hashonah. It's when the year ends, okay? Literally, the year goes out, the year ends, okay? So, my osif, what do we mean by the festival of ingathering? Ilemor, if you would mean that the meaning is simply Chag Habo Bisman Asifa, we're referring to the festival which occurs during the month, during the season of ingathering, which of course, by the way, is a perfectly good pshat for the Pasuk. I have to tell you, it's a good pshat.
Yeah, good translation.
A good translation. That when is the Sukkot festival? It's the time when they're celebrating the ingathering of the harvest, right? So, Hoksiv, then we have another Pasuk. Pasuk, in reference to Sukkot, says, Chag HaSukkos Ha'Selecho Shivas Yomim, right? I'm quoting now the entire text in the Torah. The festival of Sukkot, you are to make unto yourself, literally, for 7 days. And of course, from that we learn what? That you have to build a sukkah, and you have to dwell in the sukkah for the 7 days of Sukkot, right? And the next word I would say is, Be'ospecho, when you gather, Megorncho Mi'ikvecha. From your gorin, the gorin is the threshing floor, and this is the place where you trot out the grapes or the olives and so on. Okay. So why do we have that other pasuk? So elamai osif. So therefore, what do we mean by the word osif in the first pasuk that we quoted? So he says that means ketzir. It means
harvesting.
Okay, good. So in other words, it's a synonym for what? For harvesting. The kimlehu l'rabbonon dechol tuah shenikra b'chag b'yadua sheviya shlish lefnei Rosh Hashanah. So now he throws a new question at him. He says, "Tell me, you mean to tell me that as far as the rabbonon, as far as the rabbis are concerned, dechol tuah." Any type of grain, shenitzara, which has been harvested b'chag by Sukkot, biyodua shevia shlish l'tnei Rosh Hashanah, do you know for certain, or do the rabbis know for certain, that this plant has already grown at least a third before Rosh Hashanah? The kokori li'b'tzeis Hashanah, and therefore the Torah says the expression, at the end of the year. Is that what we're trying to say? So Rabbi Yirmiyahu Rabbi Zeira, so Rabbi Yirmiyahu said to Rabbi Zeira, they came to the Rabbanon ben Shlish, the fox and the Shlish. Tell me, he says, do the rabbis, can they distinguish between whether a plant has grown one third, or maybe it hasn't grown quite that, maybe it's grown less than a third? Are they such experts in it? No. Are you questioning the rabbis? He says to me. This is what Rab Zeira answers him, right? Omalei. So Rab Zeira says to Rab Yirmiyahu, he says, Lala min l'cho, haven't I already said to you, Lo tzapik nafshecho l'ba mi'ilchiso? You should not take yourself out of halacha. In other words, the only thing that you must do is to guide yourself by what is the halacha. And the halacha says, call midos chachomim, right? All of the various measures that the chachomim give, kenhu, that's the way it is. In other words, the chachomim are the ones who decided what is the proper measure for whatever it may be. right? Example. The Arboim saw Hutovel. The Arboim saw Choser Kortov in Yochelit Bol Bohen. All right, take the mikveh. Mikveh must have a minimum of 40 of the water in it, okay? Let's say that it is minus just the slightest fraction of it, a kortov. Kortov is a very tiny, minute measure. But it doesn't have that kortov. So in other words, it is not exactly arboim sa'ah, which is the minimum. Of course, it can have more than 40. But the minimum is 40 sa'ah, okay? A sa'ah is... it's much more, it's like a gallon or something, let's say, okay? These 40 gallons of water. I'm only using, something that we can understand. To really measure it, you need an expert on big voice who go and who measure the cubic quantity to know exactly where is the minimum line. As a matter of fact, in the average mikveh, what they do is to paint like a line or something, a tile, to indicate the fact that this is the minimum, but I naturally try to have more beyond the minimum. Okay. So, if it's missing even the tiniest fraction, a kortov, okay, which could be maybe, let's say, a 1/1000th of a sa'ah, something like that, then in that particular case, the mikveh is invalid, the inner tovel b'hem. In other words, even if he were to immerse himself in it, he has not fulfilled the mitzvah of immersion in the mikveh. Okay? So, who decided this? Torah doesn't say 40 sa'ah. The rabbis make these measurements, and they're the ones who decide that.
How do they decide on 42?
Okay, it's based upon the fact that how much of a quantity of water should there be in so that the person can immerse himself from head to foot. Understand? Because when you go into the mikveh, you have to be completely covered with water, completely. So they figure that 40 sa'ah was the minimum for a person to be completely covered with water. Okay? That's what it's based on.
It depends on how big or heavy it is. You take a fellow 6'6" versus a fellow at 5'3", it's a different thing.
I agree with you, but this is why they put in more than the minimum. They put in more than the minimum, just to be on the safe side. Okay? Of course, there are individual differences, but we're talking in terms of the average. Yeah, of course. Naturally. Goes. You have all kinds of sizes and shapes too. We're all human beings. Okay. So that was one example where the measure of the Rabbonin, that's the way that we have to go, right? Kibetza. We know that there are two basic quantities as far as what is considered a minimum for eating, okay? One of them is what we call kezias, literally the size of an olive. To us, an olive, we take a look and we see that an olive looks like something that we get out of the jar or out of the can and so on. It's not very big as a general rule, right? But I have to tell you, our great sages, they measured and measured and measured and see how much of a quantity of food this is required to just reach the stage of kezias. We know that when it comes to Pesach, you would think that you would eat, let's say, this size of matzah, you've already fulfilled the obligation.
Not so.
Not so at all. Instead, the kezias matzah that you have to eat is, pretty much the area covered by a machine-made matzah. Yeah. Yeah, something like that, right. So say about the size of a machine-made matzah. This is a kezias, okay? Based upon the fact that supposedly they crushed it and they measured it and so on and so forth, okay? So that is a kezias, okay? And for less than a kezias, you have not fulfilled that particular mitzvah, okay? Frankly, when you make a motzi, you're also supposed to be eating a kezias so that you can bench afterwards. Okay? Let's say that we don't need that much bread for it. So therefore, this is why we have a beautiful statement in the Gemara, which says, that look at the people of Israel, how they sanctify themselves. You said, for example, when it comes to benching, the achalta v'savata, right? When you eat and you feel satiated, this is when you bench. But the people of Israel took it upon themselves, what? That even if they're not satiated to that amount, nevertheless, they want to praise you and thank you for the food that they've eaten.
Even if it's satiated.
Right. Okay. So the same thing. Even if you don't eat a kesayis bread, but still, you know, we take upon ourselves with machmir that we want to express our gratitude to the Beit Shalom for the food that we eat. Okay? A larger measure than a kesayis is kibetza.
Kibetza.
Literally the size of
an egg.
An egg. Now again, you'll ask me, what kind of an egg? It's an ostrich egg. No.
is it a jumbo egg or is it a medium egg? Or?
You know, that's a good question, because I find that in the markets today, what we used to call a large egg now is about the size of what used to be called a medium egg, right? And what used to be called a medium egg today, this is, you know, it's much smaller, right,
yeah,
in quantity. And the jumbo is maybe what, as I say, what used to be considered a large egg or something like that.
They right, classify them by weight.
Yeah, correct. All right, but at any rate, this is supposed to be the average hen's egg, the average hen's egg, whatever that may. So, also, the laws of Yom Kippur depend, again, you know, at what particular point have you violated the laws of Yom Kippur if you unfortunately are required to eat something, okay? So the answer is, look, I mean, it happened to me this past Yom Kippur, I have to admit, and too, we were both sick Yom Kippur, and I had to take medication on Yom Kippur. So I took a small amount of orange juice and simply took a few sips together with it, not to be able to take, you know, the medication. The first time since I was 10 years old that I'd eaten onion kip or something. All right, technically I'm within the law to do it, but I don't have to tell you, it gave me a very, very bad feeling to do it. I felt bad.
Yeah.
But what's on the tongue, you know? The general philosophy is, you know, the kiyach nefesh, exactly. If you need it in order to save your life, and you're always hoping that next year you'll be able to do it again, you know, to do, you know, to observe it in its entirety. Yeah.
No.
Right. Yeah, well, listen, I mean, I knew the doctor had told me. Right. The doctor told me that I had to do it. And was sick at the same time. She was very sick, burning with fever and everything else. So she finally had to drink something. Right. Of course. I mean, because I had that experience. Yeah, I had it twice already after fasting. I had it after Tisha B'Av. I was very sick. And then I was very sick again after Tzom Gedalia, believe it or not. Yeah, that's a relatively short one. Yeah. Right. Sure. So, you know, in a certain case, you just have to use your good sense, and particularly if the doctor says, this is what you must do, in that case, you follow what the doctor says.
So if you have to break the fast, you can do it by just using...
Little sips, right, little sips. Or if you're required to eat... If you're required to eat, how much of a measure do you eat at one time? The answer is not more than the size of an egg, or smaller than that, preferably, and then you wait a certain amount of time, and then you can again have a little if you need it. You know, it depends upon how sick you are, you understand?
Yeah.
About the average egg, I would say, let's say, what we call a medium egg, okay? Again, I'm not 100% sure that that's exactly the way the Chachamim would say it. Yeah. Right. There are books, incidentally, that have these measures, you know, in terms of how many grams, how many ounces, particularly in terms of grams, kilograms, and so on. Because the metric system is what's used in Israel today. And so, yeah. Yeah, they use metric systems, so that apparently, you know, from a scientific point of view, scientists are using more the metric system than they use the English system.
Yep.
All right, so in the case of a Beitza, right? Mm-hmm. Here, they're dealing with another Meisen. How about the size of a Beitza? It says, Metame tumas ochlin ki Beitza. Right? Well, okay. Here we're dealing now with what we call tumas ochlin. Boy, every line introduces a new concept. It's a fact. It's like getting an encyclopedic knowledge of all kinds of different things that you find in the Torah and the Talmud and so on and so forth. Every learned. Okay. You know the whole business of tumah and tara, okay? Tara, of course, is a state of purity, and tumah, you know, is unclean. Okay. Tumah can be applied in various areas, okay? Various areas. One of them is the area of food. If a person, for example, was unclean, why? Let's say he had come in contact with a corpse, okay? And then he ate, his food would become unclean. So the question is, and you know, there's also the possibility that if you have,
if he went to the mikveh,
No, we're not talking about that. If he went to the mikveh, we're talking about right now. He sits down, he eats something, and because he is unclean, therefore the food that he eats is unclean. Okay, and in turn, it's possible that an unclean food, if it touches something else, could make that other thing unclean as well. You have different categories. In some cases, it's metame orchlin v'kelim. Understand? In other words, that the impurity, the uncleanliness, is not only orchlin food, but also the utensils that are used in order to prepare the food. If it's uncovered, it doesn't have a cover on, in that particular case, it's liable to become unclean. Yeah, pardon me?
No.
I wouldn't say tray if it's unclean. There's a big difference between the two concepts. Yeah, because trayf means that it's not kosher. Unclean has a different idea. Unclean means that a person, for example, who wanted to go to the Beis HaMikdash,
spiritually contaminated.
Right. He cannot eat that particular food, right? Because he has to, because it's unclean food. Okay, it means, for example, that we have the Gemara that deals with the Prussian, that they took upon the Chaverim, they took upon themselves the commitment that they would eat ordinary food, what we call chulin. Okay, in other words, not anything that has to deal with sacrificial food, but they would eat chulin. Bitara, in the state of cleanliness. Alright? So it means that the food that they eat had to be just as pure as if it were the type of food that they would bring to the Beis HaMikdash, right? And they themselves have to be in a state of purity at the time when they eat it. This is a special commitment that they took upon themselves. Okay? So, therefore, if something is the size of a beitza, so it says metame tumas ochlin, then in that particular case the food, if it's that size, can in turn become unclean and also transmit uncleanliness to other foods or to kalim in which it comes in contact. Okay, however, what if it is kveitza chaser shumshin, let's say, however, that is the size of a beitza, the size of an egg, right? Minus the size of a sesame seed. I mean, we all like sesame seeds from time to time, right? We know how small they are. Yet, if the beitza is the size of an egg, not quite, just missing that one little size, the size of a shumshin, the sesame seed, then it does not become unclean, or maybe it won't convey uncleanliness to other things. Okay. So this is another category. Who made this rule? The answer is the Chachamim. All right. So you have to go according to their measures. Now he brings a third category, also rules having to do with Tuman Tara. Says Shlosha al Shlosha, Metami Midras. Shlosha al Shlosha Chosen Nimo, Achas Eino Metami Midras. This is the law of Midras. It deals primarily with a Zov or a Zovo, but also in connection with the Nida. The Zova, these are the people who have, like a gonorrheal infection, okay? And as a result, there are issues forth from them, a certain sickness, okay? An issue, as we say, okay? The Nida, naturally, is a woman who is menstruating, okay? The rule in the Torah is that where you sit upon something, or you lay upon something, okay, then in that particular case, that becomes unclean, okay? So the question is, over here, how much of a quantity of material, if somebody sits on it, or leans upon it, or lies upon it, in that particular case, what must be the minimum size of such a piece of material for it to convey midras, in other words, the uncleanliness caused by moving this, okay, but by sitting upon it or lying upon it, and so on. So we learn that if it is 3 tefachim by 3 tefachim, remember, tefach is the size of a fist, supposedly, okay, somewhere 4 or 5 inches or something like that, okay. So if, in other words, it's, let's say, 12 by 12, okay, as far as inches is concerned. Or 9 by 9, depending upon whether you consider 3 inches, 4 inches, you understand? But if it is that much of a piece of material, then in that case, it becomes unclean because of this law of Midras, right? But if the article is less than that, if it's even 3 by 3, but chosen nima, just lacking what? One thread. Just the merest, the tiniest, right? Lacking simply one thread, nima achas, eino metamit midras. So,
what does that mean?
If
he misses one thread,
then it's not subject to midras. Then that is not unclean. It's not unclean. Okay. No, in this case, we're talking about a person sits upon it. The minute that he sits upon it, or he lies upon it, or something like that, you understand? Then in that case, he has made that material unclean. A person who is in a state of cleanliness is prohibited from sitting or lying upon that. You understand? I mean, this is the reason why... Okay, this leads to a basic rule. One basic rule is that because a woman menstruates, right? So, in that particular case, this is why in observant homes, you know that they have 2 beds. Yeah. Shloshat Fatim. Gimel or Gimel, okay.
It
could simply be a piece of material. Just a piece of material. Let's say you have like a kerchief, okay? To receive tumor, absolutely. Yeah, to receive tumor.
The smaller it is, the less likely it is?
That is correct. That's what they're saying. Let's say that you have a kerchief, and you put the kerchief down on a seat, okay?
Right.
And you sit down upon it, okay?
Right.
You follow me? So, all right. If the kerchief is 3 by 3 tefachim, then in that case, that kerchief now has become unclean, and you, as a clean person, should not sit upon it, okay? But if it's less than that, then it's only like a shmata or something like that. It doesn't have enough substance to be the kind of material upon which the average person is going to sit or liar. Okay?
Right.
Yeah. It all depends on the size of the keeper, right. If it's like Stanley Friedman's keeper, yeah, that's true. That's a very tiny one that he keeps on his head. Yeah. Right. All right. So, again, I mean, the whole point is that it is the rabbis who establish that this is the minimum amount of a piece of material which can then be subject to the law of Midrash. Okay? That's what we're talking about. Yeah. So, Hod Omar Rabbi Yirmiyahu. So Rabbi Yirmiyahu then said, remember, he was the one who questioned Rabbi Zeira. It was Rabbi Zeira who, you know, insisted you have to go by the Chachomim. They made the rules and that's it, right? Rabbi Yirmiyahu said, okay, Lav Milzahi. He says, I have my doubts about this. Why? The Amre, because they are those who say, the Bor Minei Chavraya Merav Kana, that the scholars asked Rav Kana, Omer Sheikrivu Yisrael Bechnisason Lo'oretz Me'echon Hekrivuhu. The Omer, which the children of Israel sacrificed as they entered Eretz Israel, where did they get the Bali, which formed the Omer for the carbon that they brought? If you remember, this is based upon the early chapters of the book of Yehoshua, the book of Joshua, okay? The book of Joshua mentions the fact, you know, that the manna ceased when? In the 40th year, the wandering of the people of Israel. Okay? There's no more manna. Okay. And then it's written that they ate of the produce of the land, in other words, of Eretz Israel, that year, Bashana Hahi. Okay? And then what they were told to do, they were also told to bring Korban Pesach. Because the people of Israel did not have a chance to celebrate Pesach during the time of the wilderness, okay, or on the move, whatever it may be. And also, they did once, I mean, in the second year they did, because it's written, you know, that's why we have the Pesach Sheni, which subsequently was to make up for those who were in no position to celebrate Pesach that year, the second year that they left Egypt, okay? But from that point on, apparently, they were unable to celebrate Pesach. And one of the reasons is that apparently the people of Israel did not circumcise any of the boys who were born in the wilderness, okay, during their journey. Probably because they felt it might be dangerous for the kid if, the conditions were not sanitary or whatever, maybe, I don't know, for whatever reason was, but they didn't practice. So in the first chapters of Yehoshua, we read that the people of Israel circumcised themselves and then they ate the Pesach, okay? They celebrated Pesach. And as I said, and it's also written that they ate of the produce of everything.